Global South founded civil society organizations have been in ascendance for decades, and they increasingly and vocally critique Global North founded NGOs for what they see as a prolonged not walking the talk on shifting power as well as resources to Global South founded organizations, aka the movement called hashtag shift of power. At the same time, the Bangladeshi-founded and decidedly transnational NGO BRAC, for several decades now, has been amongst the largest NGOs in the world. So when I had an opportunity to interview a senior leader at BRAC's high-profile Ultra-Poor Graduation Initiative, or UPGI for short, about their strategy towards diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, I jumped at that opportunity. Listening to my conversation with Rashina Tour, Senior Advocacy Manager at UPGI, about their two-pronged strategy. First, right team, which is about how to emphasize diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging values in recruitment as well as in performance management. And second, right work, which is about how to shift the locus of decision-making and authority to people most close to the impact. Have a listen. Hello, and welcome to NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye. My name is Tosca Bruno van Vijveken, and I'm the founder and principal consultant at Five Oaks Consulting. I have over three decades of experience helping leaders in civil society manage change, invest in cutting-edge leadership development, lead organizational culture change, and strengthen effectiveness. I'm also a thought leader on these issues, including as co-author of the book Between Power and Irrelevance: The Future of Transnational NGOs, which is read by civil society leaders across the globe. If you are such a leader and want to look change right in the eye, this podcast is for you. Hello, everybody. This is Tosca at NGO Soul and Strategy. And today I have a guest with me, Rashina Tour. She is the Senior Advocacy Manager at BRAC's Ultra Poor Graduation Initiative, or UPGI. And Rasha came to us because we wanted to talk about ways in which the Ultra Poor Graduation Initiative is going about its new strategy in new ways and how it's building in forward-looking ideas around diversity, equity, and inclusion and belonging into that new strategy, which made me really interested and wanted to know more. So welcome, Rasha.
Thank you.
You're so welcome. I'm looking forward to this. So to my audience, just to introduce Rasha, she is, as I said, the Senior Advocacy Manager at BRAC's Ultra Poor Graduation Initiative. She is a former Senior Strategic Direction Manager at CARE International, also a former Knowledge Management and Global Advocacy Specialist at CARE, and also, interestingly enough, Rasha had a role in research on civil society at the London School of Economics, which, of course, is very famous. So, Rasha, the Ultra Poor Graduation Initiative, that's a mouthful. Everybody knows BRAC as a brand name in civil society globally. Everybody, not everybody. People here in the US, some people in our community know BRAC USA. So tell us a little bit about the initiative, programmatically and from a mission perspective, and tell us how the initiative fits in both BRAC USA and in BRAC International.
Sure. So as you mentioned, the Ultra Poor Graduation Initiative is quite a mouthful. So moving forward, I'll just reference as UPGI. otherwise, it could take a very long every time. So just to share a little bit about UPGI, I think going back to BRAC and how it started. is really important as our origin story. So RAC, as many people know who are familiar with the institution, was founded in 1972 in Bangladesh, following in response to the aftermath of a really devastating war of independence and cyclones. And so it was really founded as a relief organization to support recovery of those who were affected. And because of this, and because it started so close to the work and really built from the impact communities, it grew into a global organization that is really rooted in evidence and learning and what works. And it really develops innovations and iterative processes to ensure that the programs and initiatives are really achieving the impact that's envisioned. And the reason I bring this up is because that leads us to the graduation approach. Mm. And so the graduation approach was it was founded in like 2002 by BRAC. And it's a holistic intervention that addresses the multiple needs and multidimensional needs of the extreme poor. And the reason why I mentioned extreme poor is because it was designed specifically for the extreme poor after realizing a program intervention that we were leading was actually not having the same level of impact for the extreme poor as those who were in lesser depths of poverty. Wow. And so this was designed to really address extreme poverty in a multidimensional and sustainable way. And what was founded is that it actually is an extremely sustainable and long-term intervention that, and I believe 93% of the participants from the Bangladesh program actually continue on an upward trajectory even 7 years following the program end, which, you know, as you know, in the development sphere is actually really unique and really, really powerful that it's not a program that ends and then they fall back into poverty, but that we actually are able to break the poverty trap for the extreme poor for the long term. And so there's obviously a lot of potential and evidence and learning there. And so UPGI was then created. So we have BRAC International, which does a lot of implementation programming outside of Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. BRAC, which is head offices in Bangladesh, focuses on scaling nationwide and addressing issues within Bangladesh. So BRAC International does implementation of the programs, including the graduation program, outside of Bangladesh with a global portfolio. And then UPGI is very specifically focused on the scaling of the graduation approach globally, with specifically through government intervention. And so just seeing the level of impact that the graduation approach can have for the extreme poor, we really want to take that initiative and scale it into government programs and policies in an effort to end extreme poverty globally and in contexts that are really have a high burden of extreme poverty as well. So we're currently housed in BRAC USA for administrative purposes, but it's really a global program that is focused on addressing extreme poverty across the globe.
Got it. I just want to pull it down a little bit more for our listeners at the in the introduction to this episode, programmatically. So what are the main, in a nutshell, what are the main program components of the graduation approach for those who are not exposed to that?
Sure. So the graduation approach has four core elements, and the interventions with each one varies depending on the context, but the core components that we feel are necessary for it to really break the poverty trap for the extreme poor are meeting basic needs, financial support and savings, mm-hmm. Income generation, and then also social empowerment. And that social empowerment component is really key to us because that includes coaching and mentoring that really ensures that the program participants have the support throughout the implementation phase to address any unexpected changes in their situation, any shocks, or also to ensure that they're really absorbing the different trainings and applying them throughout the process.
Thank you. That's very helpful. From here on, I'd like to have our discussion more at the organizational level, but I felt it was important to give it a little bit of make it a little bit more tactile. I just see it's very dark here, so let me just turn on my light. Hold on. So you won a very big grant, right? The TED
Audacious Project grant. What made that possible for UPGI, which you couldn't achieve before?
Sure. So the UPGI vision was awarded the Audacious grant, which is a long-term flexible grant for over the course of multiple years, which really allows us to put our vision into reality and the impact that we want to see into the world. So BRAC UPGI's mission and our impact goal is to break the poverty trap for 21 million people by 2026. And we really see that, obviously, that's a really big goal. Mm-hmm. And it's more than one actor can and should try to take on. And so it really relies on partnership and working through and with governments and other key stakeholders at the global, regional, and national level. And so the Audacious grant is really, it's a dream of an award, but it really allows us to fulfill our vision and our impact. And so the work that we were doing actually predates the Audacious grant, but it allows us to expand in ways that would have been probably piecemeal without it, and wouldn't allow us to really think about our long-term strategic vision. And so it really enabled us to, one, think about what is our strategic vision, and also gives us the resources to build that and to build around it, and to really think about what do we need to accomplish this, and gives us the resourcing over a longer period to build that flexibly and also with agility as we need to respond to different situations and circumstances. And so it really is really quite the gift, because it allows us to, one, have that security in our strategic vision and to plan long-term, but also to have the flexibility and agility that's really required for such a large scale vision that requires working with different actors in different ways to accomplish such an ambitious or audacious.
Yes. So it's both the strength of core funding, it's the security that comes with them and the long-term character, but also you highlighted the flexibility and agility that is built in, which is enormous. So now you and Lindsay and UPGI contacted me first and said, we want to be on your podcast because we are embarking on a new strategy. It's quite different from past strategies. And there is a link to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and also belonging to it, and to the hashtag kind of movement, Shift the Power. You talked to us about the shifting of the locus of authority and power to Global South actors into localization. That's where I would like to dive in deeper. So tell me more about how that is happening, and tell me the real story, meaning what is really promising, what has a lot of value, and what are new dilemmas and trade-offs that are showing up as you're embarking on this new strategy, supported by this big Audacious grant?
Sure. So it's not necessarily a new strategy. So it's really building off the work that we're doing. But the new opportunity is that we can build our organizational structure and our teams around our strategic vision at a level that we wouldn't necessarily have been able to do if it's contract by contract, for example. Mm, mm. So that really gave us the opportunity to really think about what are we trying to accomplish and what do we need to accomplish that. And there were, and of course, diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, which we refer to as DEI&B, and decolonizing development, were really key principles that we felt were really important to breaking into our organizational growth as we think about this big question of, as we're growing, how can we be the most impactful and the most sustainable? And we felt that those were really core components to that. And so we think about it in two streams that are obviously very connected, but also have require their own level of attention. And those are the right team, so that we can bring in the right team and the right staff. And that's looking at the diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging of our staff, and touches on localization, but also pushes us to make sure that we don't have diversity just in certain levels, but there it's really diversity and inclusion in decision-making spaces and leadership positions. Because again, we feel that that is an added value to our strategy and is going to contribute to our ability to be more impactful and to for our programming and policy changes to be more sustainable. The other approach is right work. And this is touching on something that's a little bit more, might be seen as external, but really acknowledges that you can't divide our external change without from our internal change. If we really want to see something happening externally, we need to ensure that we're built internally to enable that. And so this ensures that the impact that we're working on is building in these principles, and that the ways that we work are built on principles of diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, as well as decolonizing development. And that includes not just internally and the way that we're working, but the way that we work with impact communities, the way that we work with local civil society partners, the way we work with governments. Are we really giving voice to those spaces? Are we really enabling true partnership and participatory approach across our different ways of working? Because oftentimes in the development space, it can be very extractive processes. And so it recognizes, one, the internal and external stakeholders that we're engaging, but also internally ensuring that we don't place too much authority and decision making in a head office if the impact that we're seeing is at the local level. And so we also are trying to be really cognizant of where decisions are being made and where leadership is based to ensure that it reflects the impact communities and those closest to work, because again, we see that the way that you're going to have the most sustainability is by having those voices from the very beginning and not just as a consultative process at some points in the process that mm-hmm. are undefined and determined. So we're really looking at how we can bring those two streams together to ensure that our internal change is really enabling the external change that we want to see.
I see. So now I want to really further unpack that and tell me, Rasha, what do you do differently now, or what are you in the process of starting to do differently, right? When it comes to, let's say, recruitment and onboarding as a first thing, and then I'll ask you about some other aspects.
Sure. So I think just it's important to emphasize what we're trying to do. So
yeah,
not that we made it and we're done. This is very much these are intentions, but we are trying to build in the accountability systems to make sure that it results in the impact that we're seeking. But as far as what we're trying to do is we're trying to really challenge ourselves in our ways of working to veer away and ensure that we are recruiting diverse staff. And so one way that we did it was we considered what platforms are we posting these sites on? And is it mm-hmm. platforms that are accessible and that are used by diverse candidates? We also established that we want and made a really clear, principles that our decision-making and leadership is that we want that post to be reflective of those who are closest out of work. So in our, this is a little bit beyond the recruiting and onboarding, but in the recruitment process, we do actually include our DEIB principles to make it really clear that these are our priorities and these are our principles. And this is the type of person that we're going to need in these roles is someone who feels like these values align with their personal values. And so we embed it in the recruitment process, but we also took a look at our, at the way that we word our JDs as well, and thought about sometimes we kind of just inherit some old language and really mm-hmm. found ourselves of like, what is really required for this role?
And just to be clear, sorry to interrupt you for a moment, but for our audience, so when you use the word JD, I just want to make sure everybody, job descriptions.
Yes.
Job please description. Keep going. No, not a problem at all.
Very much acronym focused in
development
world. So when we're looking at job descriptions, we're thinking about how can we build it in equitable ways? Because the research has shown that women of color and women don't apply to roles unless they 100% fit the qualifications. Mm-hmm. And how can we put a truthful job description out there? Is a master's degree required for a administrative entry level role? what are the skill sets that are actually needed? And so we diluted we took off some of the qualifications that are actually not indicative of skill sets and really focused on this is what this role is going to be responsible for delivering and for doing on a daily basis or on a strategic level or whatever that is, to ensure that the job description isn't recruiting staff that the same kind of candidate of people who have the same kind of degree and the same kind of experience, but that it is open to people who are also interested in the role for different reasons and have different experiences, but have the relevant skill set.
Have experience profiles and lived experiences that are just as relevant, if not more relevant, for the actual skills and competencies that you need, rather than the kind of signals such as what university degree you have and where the university was, etc. Right. So talk to me also about if I think about the arc through which staff in an NGO such as UPGI may move, right? So I can think about task assignment, I can think about talent management and promotions, et cetera, rewarding staff, stretch assignments. How does UPGI try to embody these DEI and belonging, DEI plus B, as you said, principles in those processes?
So those are conversations we're very much in the middle of. And so we are bringing on a vice president of people in operations, and we're having those conversations. We had internal conversations with our staff where we co-created our DEI&B principles and our commitments of this is what we want to be really clear, is these are our commitments to diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. And then we asked staff, what does living into these commitments look like for you? And really actually created a and opened it up so that it's an inclusive process and that it's not something that's defined at the executive leadership level. That's actually really disconnected from the experiences of staff. Mm. And what we, some of the things that came out of that was having a performance management system that is very much tied to your performance goals rather than I like this person does X, Y, Z, so that you can kind of remove those implicit and explicit biases, being really clear about promotional and development opportunities, which RAC was already doing quite well. And it's not that they weren't, it's just that we have this opportunity to really remove these processes that usually have these implicit biases baked into it, whether we intentionally or unintentionally think about it.
Yeah.
So really thinking about asking staff, what will make you feel like you're in a diverse place, that you are included, that you belong, that you are equal to those who are around you in your peer group, above you and below you? And so we really opened it up to staff to define that. And then the VP, the vice president of people and operations who are going to come on, is really meant to bring that to life.
Mm.
But we really wanted to open it up to staff to ask them, what does this look like for you?
So that's on the kind of a couple of examples, and not exhaustive, but on the right team side of the work stream that you talked about. And can you also give us one or two examples of actual kind of business processes or systems that are undergoing change as a result of your diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging principles on the right work stream side?
Sure. So I think one of the examples that come to mind are the conversations we're having around how I work with local civil society actors. And so traditionally, we're Global South, but we're still an international organization.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're going to be entering into some of these countries with a country office, we need to recognize our position there. And so with the way that we're planning on working with local civil society actors has really been a topic of conversation for us of how can we work in a way that is truly supporting these local civil society institutions to support them in their efforts as credible, legitimate, and strong institutions, regardless of BRAC and regardless of our strategy. And so a typical partnership is usually very focused on implementation, but we're also looking at ways that we can work with them differently and really serve the purposes that they need. And we really saw the value of local civil society actors in COVID, when it really relied on a local presence to be able to respond to community needs. And so the value of these institutions to our long-term vision is a really key component. And so we are looking, as we're building out our new ways of working and systems and processes, we do want to leave flexibility for responding to the needs that are coming out of key stakeholders that we identified as local civil society actors that we want to really be supporting and investing in. And that might be flexible funding, that could be a facilitating role into global processes, co-creating advocacy opportunities. It could be capacity support. There's such a variety of ways to interact, but we really want it to be a true partnership and to really remove the dynamics of we're funding INGO, which we will not be in that presence. We're going to be a local. We're going to be working with governments and stakeholders in country, but we really want to be promoting true partnership and a participatory approach with local civil society actors and hear from them how we can support their work and provide that and not be bound by our internal structures of, well, this is the way that we can support you because we have to wait till we have a contract and put you in as an implementing partner, which is a traditional model. But we really want to be moving beyond that, especially as we think about our advocacy and policy change. We want to bring those voices into the processes and systems that we're working on.
Got it. I want to move to a question on trade-offs that you've encountered and dilemmas and complications. But before we go there, kind of question that came up for me was, so BRAC as a whole is a Bangladesh-founded global organization. As UPGI went about its work of inserting diversity, equity, and inclusion and belonging into your strategy expansion, because unlike what I said in the beginning, right, it's really an expansion and broadening of your strategy rather than a new strategy. But did it matter that BRAC's identity is that of a global NGO founded in Bangladesh? Did it matter for how you went about diversity, equity, and inclusion and belonging, you think?
I'm not sure I understand. Did it matter?
Yeah. So what I'm asking is did the identity of BRAC as a global NGO that was founded in Bangladesh, did that have an imprint on how you went about thinking about diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, or not necessarily? I'm just curious.
I can understand why that would be a question, because usually a lot of the international organizations are born in Western countries. I think that the process that we're undergoing is actually very aligned with how BRAC has started, formed, and grown. And so localization and the value of local voice in shaping these programs in that close proximity to the work and the impact communities is a big part of BRAC's work. And so we're really bringing that same ethos to these conversations. It's just at a different scale. So whether you're from the US or from Bangladesh, going into Uganda, you're not from Uganda. So it really is looking at how can we really leverage local expertise and local experience and local evidence and learning to design these solutions. And we're bringing something, we're of course bringing in our graduation approach that has some evidence on scaling and everything, but it also is meant to be adapted. And that's also the beauty of it. So built in the graduation approach, built into BRAC's growth, whether it's BRAC International or different components, is a recognition of this needs to be built with local communities. Mm-hmm. And so it's not, I wouldn't say that it's different. I think that it's just, it's a different application of it.
Okay. I was just curious. It popped up in my mind. Now to my question of as you are expanding your strategy in this way, what are new dilemmas or trade-offs that you're encountering as you have this greater focus on decolonizing aid, right team, right work? Are there new problems popping up that you did not have to think about before?
That's a good question. I think this may seem overly positive, but I don't think that there are any dilemmas. I think or takeaways. I think that this is something that the international organization should really be doing, and so I think it's actually a really great opportunity. And of course, it's a change process. It's changing the way that you think. It's changing the status quo of the sector. But I think it's actually a really exciting opportunity. And hopefully will, if successful, and if it does result in what we're hoping of more sustainable and more local, more impactful program, because it's more locally based and because we were able to really center the work where we're at the national level, we're hoping that that can actually provide learning and evidence for other actors in our space and peer organizations. So of course, it's definitely, it requires you to challenge yourself. It requires you to think about, is the way that we were doing it, is there a different way to do it than the way that we've been doing it to align with our vision, to align with our principles? And so it does require you to challenge yourself and to challenge each other. But again, the whole reason we're doing it is because we do feel like that's going to be more, that's what needs to happen. And so it's not a takeaway as much as this is the process that it takes to reach that. And so it definitely is a really interesting opportunity that I think is so important to be able to just step back and build something for purpose rather than creating this, working through systems that don't necessarily serve your vision or don't necessarily serve the new and different ways that you want to be working. And so I would say that there's no takeaways. I mean, it requires a lot of time. You're doing something different. So it requires you to sit and think about what do we need to build and have conversations, of course, with external stakeholders and the local communities to ensure that you're also not baking it yourself, because that goes against the principles of what you're on. And so I think that the only thing is that it takes time and you need to dedicate the time to that and the staff and the resources. But I wouldn't say that that's a dilemma or a takeaway. I think it's a really good use of your time.
Right. How do local and national governments in the countries where UPGI works respond to this focus on decolonizing aid, localizing decision-making and authority to the lowest possible level, working in a different way with local civil society, and working presumably in a different way with them as government entities, right? So what do you see as the reactions? Positive? Is it a combination of positive, neutral, and negative? I'm curious.
So we're still in the process of building our teams out that will be based globally. Obviously, COVID really delayed that process. We have been working previously, as I mentioned, with governments and supporting the strengthening of their social protection programs and policies. Mm. And I think that our approach is actually very welcome because we're not trying to work in parallel with the government. We're trying to embed our learning and our evidence and collaborate and partner with these local actors, the national government or local civil society, to strengthen what they're doing based on global evidence and learnings, as much as it serves their goals of ending extreme poverty or whatever it is that they define as their mission. And so we're really looking to scale through their existing efforts and their existing vision and commitments and not coming in and enforcing this is our agenda. And so we really hope that they see us as a partner for accomplishing their own goals and the impact that they want to see in country. And that's also why we're hoping to enter these conversations and why we're trying to build our structure in a way that enables that, so that it is not a we're here, this is what we're doing, but that we're entering in a very consultative, collaborative, partner-based way on how can we support your efforts and the work that we're doing. So we're really entering as a partner rather than this is what we're doing and we'll work with you sometimes. Mm. But working through their efforts and working to support their national agendas.
Though what you told us earlier about aiming to work more in true partnership with local civil society, does that objective and the implications thereof being more responsive, as you said, to their evolving needs, does that ever bump up against local or national government hesitation around their very role or giving them more agency? I could imagine that the government, your government partners love to have the extra agency because that's what most human beings like, right? But how about when it comes to your civil society actors?
Sure. And that's a great question, because I think that oftentimes governments and civil society actors are seen as opposites of two people who are doing two different things. But we're working with governments on their social protection systems and their policies and programs that are in place to support the people living in poverty or extreme poverty in their community. Civil society actors have a variety of agendas and purposes that they're serving in country. And so they're not necessarily, our mission is looking at ending extreme poverty. And each actor brings a unique value add to that space as an international organization, as a civil society actor, as a government. And so part of our process as we're entering in a country is we're having those conversations with governments and with local civil society actors, and like, what role do you want to play in this? Mm-hmm. What is it that you're trying to accomplish? And it could be that they actually don't want to be. Some civil society actors might be like, we actually don't want to be involved with an international organization at all. Some might be like, actually, we really want to be addressing this global policy that is being that isn't being implemented here, or that we need to be implemented here. Mm-hmm. So it really requires a consultative process to see, and a really comprehensive strategy to ensure that, one, we're also not pitting them against each other, because that's obviously not
right.
But seeing how can we support both actors in sustainable ways in what is what also makes sense for us as an international actor who has a lot of evidence. And it could be that with local civil society actors, we're really a facilitator with a lot of the access to learning and evidence and innovations that we have in this space. That could be what they really need if they're an isolated local organization. And then we could be that, or it could be that they want to facilitate a coalition space, where a multi-stakeholder space, where it is bringing together governments and civil society actors who are really working towards the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we're really looking to see how we can contribute to each of their goals. And there's a really specific opportunity with the graduation approach to work with governments on their social protection systems and policies and anti-poverty programs and policies to make them more impactful for the extreme poor. But we also have a different stakeholder with civil society actors who are going to have a different agenda, a different goal, and it's going to require conversations with those actors to see how we can best support them, so that we're also not enforcing our idea of what they need from us or what we could do to contribute to them. But we certainly see it critical to at least have those conversations with both actors and see how we can, what makes sense for us as BRAC to support them.
Mm. I have two more questions. You told us before that you used to work in CARE International, and there too, there has been, before you left, there was a discussion around how power is distributed, right? And links to diversity, equity, and inclusion. What did you learn in care? What observations did you take with you into your work in UPGI that proved to be helpful?
Sure. The last 5 years that I was with care, it was based in DC, but before that, I actually started with care at the field office. And so mm-hmm. that really shaped my perspective of the development space by seeing the experience of a country office in a really large international organization. And so my takeaway has just been the importance of speaking to people, the staff and the partners at the level of impact and who's working at with the communities and who are the closest level of proximity to that work. And really centering those voices and those perspectives in the decision-making process from the very beginning. And so when I was at CARE in DC in my role with the Policy and Advocacy Department, a part of it was supporting the US government engagement, a part of it was supporting our regional advocacy and mm-hmm. national advocacy. And what I saw was really important was there's the value, the knowledge that is at the local level is so critical. And if we really want to be having the most impact, those voices and the staff that are working there really need to be empowered to be making the decisions that they need to make in order to do their work and not have burdens placed on by head offices, but to be able to operate and to have that authority and that flexibility and agility to work. And so what I have taken from there and what I will always take with me is just the value of having diverse and beyond value, the importance of having those who are closest to the work in decision making and leadership spaces.
That's what I hear you say time and time again in this interview. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I think without that, you're not going to have a significant change.
Yeah.
And if they're just brought in, if those perspectives are just brought in at different moments, then that's not going to result in the change and sustainable impact that we're looking for, and which is really what drove all of us who are in this field to this field. It's because
right.
So I really see that as closely tied to the impact of these organizations. And again, it's not that we won't be impactful. It's that our work will be more impactful and will be more sustainable if we do this. And so that's something that I'll take with me forever.
Right. So let me ask you an open-ended question. And ask you to just finish the sentence. So it's actually not a question. It's a sentence that I'm going to start. I'm asking you to finish it as we get towards the end of our interview. Before we as UPGI make our next move in this strategy expansion, we cannot neglect to dot, dot, dot. How would you end that sentence?
Well, I'm a broken record at this point. So not neglect to center the voices of those closest to our work in the decision.
Okay. Okay, fair enough. So, Rasha, if people want to learn more about you as an individual and also about UPGI's journey, where should they go?
Sure. So they can follow me on LinkedIn. My name's Rasha Natura on there, of course. And then for BRAC UPGI, if they're interested in following our work, which I think is very exciting, then they can follow us on LinkedIn or Twitter.
On both these channels? Mm-hmm. Okay, good. We will put that in the show notes. Well, thank you, Rasha, for all your insights today. And thank you, listeners. If you found this podcast episode stimulating, then please check out the other episodes, both on the audio podcast on my website, fiveoaksconsulting.org, as well as on my new YouTube channel, where all the recent episodes have been posted as well. We also, in our book, a co-authored with George Mitchell and Hans-Peter Schmitz, are talking about some of the issues that Rasha talked about today. That book is called Between Power and Irrelevance, The Future of Transnational NGO. So for any and all information, hop over to my website, fiveoaksconsulting.org. This is Tosca, and I look forward to spending time with you next time again.
Thanks for listening to my podcast. If you valued the content, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so that other leaders of social change organizations can find it too. And if you want to learn more, have a look at my website, fiveoaksconsulting.org, where you will find blog posts, recordings of interviews with me, as well as information about my co-authored book, Between Power and Irrelevance, The Future of Transnational NGOs. If you sign up for my email list, you will receive a free sneak peek at the book. Or feel free to email me at tosca@fiveoaksconsulting.org or contact me through my website. And follow me on social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. Till we talk again at NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye.